Hello, everyone. Welcome to Tuesday Night Rheumatology. I'm Jack Cush with Rheum Now. Tonight, Tuesday Night Rheumatology is going to feature a replay session from Rheum Now Live 2024. This particular session on spondyloarthritis occurred on Sunday, January 28th. We have three great speakers, and we're going to show you key excerpts from their talks. We'd like to thank the sponsor of this session, UCB, as we've brought you a lot of replay content from this session, and that's all thanks to UCB. What am I talking about? Well, we have this Tuesday Night Rheumatology. You've seen some articles this week in on the website on Rheum Now, a bunch of tweets this week. But more importantly, there are basically two videos, Leon Gintzler's full lecture on the future of spondyloarthritis therapy, and then this video that's going to be available, and then two podcasts that are available. There's going to be a replay availability of Dr. Eric Ruderman's full lecture on non-radiographic axial SpA, and there's another one. I guess the replay of this in podcast form would also be out there. So. Oh, and then also the panel discussion. These three lectures end with a half-hour panel discussion. That's one of the unique things about Rheum Now Live is that we have short lectures and then a really long amount of discussion and Q&A with the faculty. So let's get into it. If you have any questions, please click on the Q&A box. We'll answer them during the session. We're going to first begin with Dr. Eric Ruderman from Northwestern University. Eric, fabulous teacher, is going to distinguish between non-radiographic axial SpA and ankylosing spondylitis, otherwise known as radiographic axial SpA. He's going to get right into a question for you. So let's listen up to Dr. Ruderman.
What is non-radiographic axSpA? What distinguishes this from ankylosing spondylitis? The duration of disease, response to treatment, sacroiliitis, or functional impairment? What's the main differentiating factor? Enough. Yes, that's all it is. It is simply a diagnosis. In effect, it's a diagnosis of exclusion in that it means that you have axial spondyloarthritis and don't have radiographic sacroiliitis. So you get lumped into this bucket. And what I'm going to try to persuade you in the next few minutes is that making that call doesn't actually change what we do very much. All right. So here's where this all comes from. The history of axial spondyloarthritis. So for years, you all know we had the modified New York criteria for ankylosing spondylitis. I have never seen the unmodified criteria published to the best of my knowledge, but this is what we have. And you have ankylosing spondylitis if you have one of the clinical criteria, which has to do with pain and mobility, and the radiographic criteria, which says you have sacroiliitis. And if you have a clinical criteria and definite radiographic findings, you have ankylosing spondylitis. And in the past, if you had the clinical criteria, but without radiographic sacroiliitis, you had probable AS, okay? And we all know what the sacroiliitis is, but the problem is it's often in the eye of the beholder because historically, when we've seen trials of ankylosing spondylitis, when the radiographs are read locally and then sent for central read, the correlation between local interpretation of radiographs by the radiologist at your institution and what's read centrally by a radiologist trained to look for this is terrible. Okay. So, with all that, this led to the idea a few years back, about 15 years ago, to say, well, what are we missing by sticking with the diagnosis of ankylosing spondylitis? And the genesis of this was always the idea of like, let's update those criteria because the modified New York criteria date to 1983, I believe, and it was really the last criteria in medicine that relied on plain radiographs. And with the advent of more advanced imaging like CT and MRI, which really didn't exist. CT was in its early days in 1983, and MRI was barely around. We didn't have those options. And then there was the observation that there were people, particularly women, who had symptoms very consistent with axial disease, with inflammatory back disease, who did not have sacroiliitis. So that's what led to this sort of rethinking of things about 15 to 20 years ago, with the idea that maybe this was a little bit like rheumatoid arthritis, and that you got symptoms first, later got radiographic change, and we want to update the classification criteria to not rely on the radiographic findings, because that's going to wait too long. And if your goal is to try to figure out who has the disease so that you can intervene and treat their disease early, waiting for x-rays, it may take too long. And so that was sort of where this came, is that maybe this was sort of a progression over time, and that you had pre-radiographic disease and then later radiographic disease. And that's where this all came from. And where this came from was a recognition that there are people who fit, and that if you start to apply some of these newer imaging studies, you can identify them. But at the same time, this was an international work, and it recognized that there are some places in the world where it's not so easy to get an MRI. And so that's where the clinical criteria came in. And this was developed by the ASAS working group. They thought they were very clever, okay, because they came up with a term, axial spondyloarthritis, which had the same initials as AS. And they thought, well, that's going to make it easier because we're just going to sort of transition. That has then confused people for the last 15 years because the terminology gets really challenging. But the idea was that if you've got the people we know about who have chronic low back pain with an inflammatory feel to it, pain in the morning that gets better as you move around, et cetera, at an early age of onset, and imaging that could include an x-ray, could include a CT scan, or could include an MRI that showed sacroiliac changes, then you had the disease. This was axial spondyloarthritis. But then they also said, well, wait a minute, if you can't get that imaging, at least have a positive HLA-B27, which many of you who've been in this for a while will remember that we stopped ordering them for a while because it didn't really change anything. But that sort of come back with this and said, if you had at least two of the clinical features and a B27 and you couldn't get the imaging, then you could still qualify. And the intent was not to say if the imaging was negative, you qualify. It was that if it wasn't available to you, basically. And it turned out to be very helpful. And unquestionably, the imaging arm gives you much better specificity because you've got something objective to hang your hat on. But if you just do it with clinical arm, the specificity and sensitivity was pretty good. And overall, it actually turned out to be a reasonable way to make this diagnosis. And I will point to the fact on the top that the gold standard is a rheumatologist said you had it, right? Which is what happens with a lot of our classification criteria. We're trying to come up with a criteria, but at the end of the day, the real gold standard is a thoughtful, qualified rheumatologist says they have the disease, and do the people they believe have the disease fit according to those criteria? So that's where we came from. So where did this non-radiographic piece come up? Well, that happened after they did this. And the idea was, these are people who meet those criteria and have axial spondyloarthritis, but they don't meet the New York criteria for AS, which means they don't have sacroiliitis. They're going to meet the clinical part of that, but they don't have sacroiliitis. And so now you take this broader category of axSpA or AS, if you want to be fancy, because it's the same initials, and you get either radiographic axSpA, which is what we always thought about as ankylosing spondylitis, and hang on to that thought because I'm going to circle back to that at the very end, or non-radiographic axSpA, which are the people who have this axial disease but don't have sacroiliitis. Are they different diseases? And that's the critical question. That's what I want to spend the rest of the time on talking about. And the issue is that this isn't a continuous progression. These aren't necessarily people who start at non-radiographic disease and eventually progress to radiographic disease. They have all sorts of pathways on this. And there are people who develop axial spondyloarthritis who don't have sacroiliitis who will never develop sacroiliitis. And it's outside the scope of this talk, but that's frequently women because women get less radiographic change over time. And so some people will eventually get to really severe AS if you follow them over time. Some people even present like that, but some people will always stay in this sort of non-radiographic area. And what does that mean in terms of treatment? Well, let's step back for a second and think about epidemiology and how much of each are there really out there? And there's not a ton of really good data, but there are some good studies that looked at this. So this is some NHANES data from a few years back that looked at a survey of representative US adults to figure out who has ankylosing spondylitis. And they found that overall, using a reported diagnosis of ankylosing spondylitis, they didn't have x-rays to look at in the NHANES survey, reported diagnosis was about 0.5%. But if they expanded the criteria and these Amore and ESSG criteria, sort of like the precursors to the ASAS-ACSPA criteria, that it was about a percentage. And so, in other words, about 50% of the people who have axial spondyloarthritis have AS, and 50% sort of don't meet A, or at least have not been told they have AS by criteria. And another study that I actually had a chance to be involved in that got published about 10 years ago was a CHARGE study that went back and looked at charts of rheumatologists across the country. Not to get into the details, they picked 100 rheumatologists, four areas of the country. They had them go look into their charts from people who had chronic back pain in their practice and screen them against these ASAS criteria. And what's key are the bottom two boxes on the right. When they drilled down on all these folks, they were able to classify a percentage of them as AS and a percentage of them as non-radiographic axSpA, and it was relatively equal. And so what I'm saying here is what I think is important is that when you think of the universe of axSpA out there, roughly 50% of those people have sacroiliitis that defines them as what we used to term AS, or ankylosing spondylitis, and 50% don't. Does it matter? Well, it turns out they're very similar, okay? This is from a slide deck that the ASAS folks put out. This is an international working group, and they looked at what defines non-radiographic disease from AS from a couple of different cohorts, and it included people with early AS versus long-term AS, and they are about the same with two differences. The people with AS tend to be more likely to have an abnormal acute phase reactant, CRP. Okay. But even in those situations, only about half of them. And the people with AS, less likely to be women. Okay. And part of that is maybe underdiagnosis and under-recognition, but I think a lot of it is that women tend to have fewer radiographic changes on their x-rays, so they don't get picked up as AS. Now, to the point of, do they eventually turn into AS? The answer is not so much. Or at least that we know about. So this is some data from Mayo, the Olmsted County database. Not a big series, it's only 81 patients, but they picked up people with non-radiographic axSpA. Now this is before the diagnosis came out, so they went back in a retrospective chart review, and then they followed them out for 10 years to see how many of them actually eventually progressed to AS with sacroiliitis, and it was a very small percentage. It was only about a quarter of them, and over 10 years, the majority of these folks never actually developed AS. They continue to have non-radiographic disease. All right, so with that a backstory, let me swing into treatment. How do we treat these folks? Well, the ASAS-EULAR recommendations haven't changed. So they took these recommendations from ankylosing spondylitis, ported them over, and said, we're now axial spondyloarthritis. But at heart, they're largely the same recommendations, which says, you need a rheumatology diagnosis, and just take a look at that second box. I'm going to come back to that. If you fail standard treatment with an NSAID, chronic NSAID use, then you get put on a biologic therapy. That was kind of always the way they looked at this, and it was a challenging sort of set of recommendations because there was nothing in between NSAIDs and expensive biologic therapy, unless you had peripheral disease, and then there's some potential role for sulfasalazine in there, or some of us will often use methotrexate if it's peripheral manifestations. What if it's axial disease? And these criteria have been updated over the years, and they haven't changed very much. The updates have mostly been that they started with TNF inhibitors, then added interleukin-17 inhibitors as an option, and now have JAK inhibitors as an option. Okay. And although they still say most people start with a TNF or an IL-17 inhibitor. Now, back to the second box. As they updated the recommendations, they said axial spondyloarthritis, you treat it like ankylosing spondylitis, like we always did, with the caveat that if they have non-radiographic disease, if they don't have sacroiliitis on X-ray, you need to have a positive MRI or an elevated acute phase reaction with CRP to justify treatment with a biologic, because you have to have some objective evidence that they have inflammatory disease, because 25% of these patients, like all of our diseases, have a component of non-inflammatory pain, and that's not going to respond to biologic therapy. And I'm going to show you that in the data in a second. Okay, so with that in mind, before we get into the data, a quick poll. Which of these therapies is more effective for ankylosing spondylitis than it is for non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis? TNF, IL-17, JAK, or none? We'll move on. So most of you got it. So it turns out there is no difference. They're equally effective, and I'll show you the data. So here is some registry data. This is from Sweden. They took 86 folks with non-radiographic spondyloarthritis, 200-something folks with AS, okay? Very similar baseline demographics. And it turns out their response to therapy, these were people starting a TNF inhibitor, their response to therapy by pretty much every measure of response was equivalent. And the differences they noticed, like I told you before, is that there are more women in the non-radiographic group, and they tend to have a lower C-reactive protein. And so you can see on the bottom right there that the AS group with the open circles started out much higher, had a bigger drop, never got as low with CRP. But in every other regard, they respond about the same. That's broad from a registration study. We actually have clinical trial data that shows the same thing. So here is adalimumab, okay? The ATLAS trial, which was their primary registry trial for ankylosing spondylitis, and later the ABILITY-1 trial that was for non-radiographic disease.
Okay, great session from Dr. Ruderman. I want to thank him for his contributions. As he's going to go on and discuss many other trials with both IL-17 and the TNF inhibitors, and I think some JAK data showing equivalent responses between non-radiographic axial SpA and axial SpA. So that's sort of the takeaway. If you want to come hear the complete lecture beginning to end, it's available as a podcast now on our podcast channel if you listen to our podcast. Again, if you have any questions, now's the time to ask. I want to thank UCB for sponsoring this session. Our next speaker we featured 2 weeks ago, and that was Dr. Leahy Eder from the University of Toronto. In this session, she talks about one of her favorite topics, which is enthesitis in spondyloarthritis, its biology, its approach. In the prelude to what I'm going to start with, she says that it's seen in at least one-third of patients with spondyloarthritis. And now she's going to get into the biology behind it and the diagnosis of it. So let's listen to Dr. Leahy Eder on enthesitis in spondyloarthritis.
There is also more interest in understanding of how enthesitis develops, and this is a really nice review paper by Georg Schett that outlines the different phases of development of enthesitis. So it's thought that biomechanical stress is a major triggering factor for inflammation that would start at the bone marrow, and from there, immune cells, and in particular neutrophils and other immune cells, would migrate into the enthesis through small canals in the bone, and then it would lead to the acute phase where there is swelling and vasodilatation of the enthesis. And later on, when this process becomes more chronic, it would lead to some changes in the bone, like new bone formation and erosions. And there is some clinical data to suggest that indeed enthesitis is a feature that occurs in patients before they develop psoriatic arthritis. There's been multiple studies now that have shown that people with psoriasis that do not have any symptoms have subclinical enthesitis that can be detected by ultrasound. And the higher scores of enthesitis are also associated with some of the clinical risk factors for progression from psoriasis to PSA, such as high BMI and nail lesions. So you may ask yourself, okay, so how important this subclinical enthesitis is this predicting future progression to PSA? It still remains a bit controversial, but there are some smaller studies that suggested that people with higher scores of enthesitis based on ultrasound, especially if they have arthralgia or symptoms, are more likely to progress to future clinical psoriatic arthritis. There's also data that show the importance of enthesitis as the link between nail lesions and DAP involvement in psoriatic arthritis. And this is on the right-hand side, you can see a histologic section that is showing that these fibers of the extensor tendon are really continuing from the tendon and insert into the base of the nail. And therefore, when there is inflammation at this enthesis, at the DAP insertion, this can be associated with inflammation of these fibers at the nail bed, and that may explain the fact that there is nail lesions and the close clinical connection between nail lesions and DAP involvement. And here you can, on the left-hand side, you can see an ultrasound image of someone with DAP disease, and you can see there both synovitis here, synovitis of the DAP joint. This is the enthesis of the extensor tendon, and you can see some of the fibers here that link into the nail bed. So again, enthesitis might be the unifying feature that connects this synovitis, enthesitis, and the nail lesions. Enthesitis is recognized as an important feature in classification criteria, both in the GRAPPA classification criteria, the CASPAR classification criteria for PSA. So a patient can be classified as having PSA only if they have, even if they only have enthesitis as a feature. And it's also considered to be an associated feature in axial SpA. So you're all rheumatologists, you know how to examine enthesitis, and you also, I'm sure, recognize the fact that this is very inaccurate assessment because we really rely on palpation, and if the patient is saying, ouch, then we say, okay, this is clinical enthesitis. And the fact that, you know, people talk about swelling, but swelling is really uncommon. And in most entheses, it's really impossible to detect swelling. The only one I had to look very hard to find a picture of a swollen entheses, and this is the Achilles tendon, where to me, this is really the only site that you can actually detect some swelling. So this is a very subjective assessment. And there are clinical scoring systems that are used in clinical trials. For psoriatic arthritis, the Leeds Enthesitis Index and the SPARC are the recommended tools, and they focus mostly on the peripheral enthesis. And for axial SpA, the MASES, the Maastricht scoring system is the one that is has shown better performance. It's mostly assessing central enthesis. So these are using trials. Personally, I do assess it in my clinic. I prefer to use the SPARC, which is including more sites, and it helps me, at least within the same individual, record whether there is any improvement, at least in the pain component of enthesitis over time. There has been quite a lot of studies that show that enthesitis can influence the burden of musculoskeletal symptoms. This is one study from Toronto showing that about a third of the patients with PSA had at least one tender enthesis at some point during the course of their disease. And having higher enthesitis score was associated with more actively inflamed joints, with dactylitis, tenosynovitis, and more pain. And in axial SpaS, the same has been shown again with about a third of the patients having enthesitis at baseline that was slightly higher in non-radiographic axial SpaS compared to ankylosing spondylitis. And they also show that the presence of acute enthesitis was associated with higher BASDAI score and with more physical dysfunction, and was also predicting whether a patient was with patients with enthesitis was less likely to achieve ASAS low disease activity state. So in both of these disease conditions, people that have enthesitis tend to have higher burden of pain and more dysfunction, more active disease. But it's not just the pain component, and especially when enthesitis is confirmed, but in ultrasound, it is a marker of more severe, at least in the case of PSA. And we have shown that a higher enthesitis score by ultrasound is associated with more risk of having radiographic damage, both in the peripheral joints as well as in the axial joints. So this is something to keep in mind, that it is an important feature of the disease and is associated with development of more damage, maybe mediated by HLA-B27, as this gene is known to be a marker of more severe PSA, and it's also been associated with development of enthesitis. So I touched upon this inaccuracy of assessment of enthesitis by physical exam. So enthesalgia, if you may refer to, is really non-specific. And these are results from the DUET study, which is a study that we are currently analyzing and is done through GRAPPA. And the goal of this study is to develop a sonographic scoring system for enthesitis in PSA. So we compared patients with established diagnosis of psoriatic arthritis to patients who were controls from patients who were just seen in rheumatology clinics for non-inflammatory diseases like osteoarthritis, fibromyalgia. And you can see that although 70% of the patients with PSA had at least one tender enthesis, so do 50% of the controls. So this is really not very useful, right, to make a diagnosis of enthesitis. And this is also complicated by the fact that in people that have a diagnosis of PSA but also have fibromyalgia, they tend to have positive tender enthesis and higher enthesitis score. And it's really hard to distinguish based on the physical examination what is the fibromyalgia and what is the active enthesitis. So why do we still use physical exam to make a diagnosis of enthesitis? I don't know. I really find it a little bit, you know, we do have such good tools, and ultrasound is such as a useful tool. So why are we still using the physical exam? I really think that more rheumatologists should adopt imaging, especially when considering this feature of the disease. So what do we see in ultrasound? And there are different lesions that have been associated with enthesitis and have been defined by OMERACT. And they are broadly categorized into inflammatory and structural lesions. So when we consider inflammatory, we have swelling of the enthesis. So you can see the thickness of the enthesis compared to the body of the tendon. There is hypoechogenicity, which is this loss of normal fibrillar pattern of the tendon. And of course, there is increased vascularization, which is the Doppler signal. The structural lesions are seen in longer term inflammation. So after there is prolonged inflammation, and these include both erosion on top here and new bone formation. You can see these small calcification and new bone formation there. But there are caveats, and ultrasound is not as simple as we think it is, because some of these lesions are not specific and can be found in normal individual as they get older, or in people who have diabetes or people who are more obese. So it's more the combination of these lesions, and some of these lesions tend to be more specific to inflammatory enthesitis like Doppler signal and newborn erosion. So it really does require some experience, some expertise, but just the presence of one of these lesions is not sufficient. And as always, ultrasound is just a tool that can help, and it depends on the pretest and likelihood of the patient having this disease. So it's just another tool that could help the clinician in the clinic, but the clinical context need to be taken into account as well. I'll just mention MRI briefly because I think MRI is useful in certain situations. I don't use it a lot to make a diagnosis of enthesitis. It's very helpful when considering the deeper entheses where ultrasound is not very useful, such as the gluteal area or enthesial sites in the spine where ultrasound again is not useful. The problem with MRI is that it can only assess one site at a time. There are issues of cost and access, and you don't get an immediate response like at the point of care like you get with ultrasound. The lesions that can be seen are both inflammatory and structural, same as with ultrasound, but the only thing that basically an MRI can detect that ultrasound cannot detect is bone edema. It's not when you compare ultrasound to an MRI for superficial enthesial sites, there is really no advantage to MRI. It's mostly for these deep entheses where MRI is more useful. And there is a lot of interest in this whole body MRI, which could potentially give us a picture of what is happening in all of these entheses. But at this point in time, this still remains a research tool because there are some issues with resolution and some of the sites, the enthesial sites, are not really demonstrated very well with this technology. So hopefully in the future, MRI could play a better role in assessing the whole enthesial sites. So how do we treat active enthesitis? And as I mentioned, I'll go over mostly the GRAPPA treatment guidelines because these are the most updated guidelines and they have a special section on enthesitis. This is another paper that came up and was dealing specifically with the literature on enthesitis. So these are really recommended, the NSAIDs is recommended as potentially first line in and have been used traditionally to treat symptoms of enthesitis.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Eder. She was going to get into the many therapies that were listed in that GRAPPA guideline that are known to be useful, and there's many. The bottom line on that is that no one of the therapies is superior to the others. NSAIDs may be first line, but it's a long line of other drugs. So all the new drugs, the ones that are approved for spondyloarthritis and PSA, do work in enthesitis, and they seem to work equally well, but there also are no head-to-head studies, at least not yet. So again, I want to encourage you, if you have any questions, to put them in the box. We're going to end with our last speaker, Dr. Leanne Gensler from the University of California at San Francisco. Leanne's a world leader in research and education on spondyloarthritis. Luckily, she was one of our featured speakers at the program. She's going to talk about therapy in spondyloarthritis and future therapy. We'll kind of cut off the future therapy because it gets into combination, speculative drugs, drugs not yet approved, a little less appropriate. But if you want to see the whole lecture, you can see it both on Room Now and on our YouTube channel. So let's listen up to Dr. Leanne Gensler on future therapy in spondyloarthritis.
This is the ASIS-EULAR guidelines, and so this is new. We used to sort of think about TNF inhibitors as second line after NSAIDs in patients that needed to escalate, and what you see here is that IL-17 inhibitors and TNF inhibitors are put on a lateral playing field as the agent you would go to next after NSAIDs have failed or you are intolerant to. And then also taking into account the extramusculoscopal manifestations. We've known for a long time that if you have inflammatory bowel disease or frequently recurrent uveitis, you would want to pick a monoclonal antibody-based TNF inhibitor. Here we know that psoriasis, IL-17 inhibitors are better for psoriasis than TNF inhibitors. And so with a significant burden of psoriasis, you might consider an IL-17 inhibitor. So in the presence of pustular psoriasis warranting systemic therapy and radiographic axial spondyloarthritis, an IL-17 inhibitor was started. To dramatic improvement in the symptoms and resolution of the psoriasis and serologic inflammation. And I just want to highlight the secukinumab data. This is not new in radiographic and non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis with response compared to placebo, primary endpoint at 16 weeks. A third of these patients could have been TNF inadequate responder or exposed. And some new evidence for secukinumab in particular, this is actually from RheumNow. Very recently, IV secukinumab was approved for axial spondyloarthritis and psoriasis, psoriatic arthritis. And so that is actually quite helpful for us in the United States because for Medicare patients, this becomes a much more affordable option than the sub-Q formulations of the biologics. And I think it's also helpful to think about the phase two data in acute anterior uveitis, where we actually saw efficacy in a phase two trial with IV secukinumab for uveitis, which we know that the sub-Q formulations don't treat uveitis. So you might consider using this in a patient that also has uveitis. We had no head-to-head data compared to TNF inhibitors, but this is reassuring and encouraging for a certain population of patients. And then just also highlighting that secukinumab is now approved for hidradenitis suppurativa with efficacy there. And so an expanding indication for IL-17 inhibitors. And certainly several of our patients with axial spondyloarthritis will also have HS, either alone or in association with inflammatory bowel disease. And we'd not be using this in the setting of IBD though. Looking at ixekizumab, so this was done in TNF-naive and TNF-experienced patients with radiographic axial spondyloarthritis. That's why you see a little bit of a lower response in the experienced group. But of course, we have efficacy for ixekizumab too, and for fair balance, I'm showing all of the data. And then in non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis, remember this was a 52-week trial, and so you can see both at 16 weeks for the EU and then 52 weeks for the US response to treatment compared to placebo. So I showed you that because I wanted to bring in new data, and that's the bimekizumab data, which was first published in comparison to secukinumab for plaque psoriasis. And this was the New England Journal of Medicine study, which showed that patients on bimekizumab compared to 300 milligrams of sub-Q secukinumab had a better response for complete clearance of skin. They also have more oral candidiasis when you inhibit IL-17A and IL-17F instead of IL-17A alone. So let's look at the data in axial spondyloarthritis. This is, of course, not yet approved in axial spondyloarthritis. It is approved in psoriasis. So this is the data using an ASAS40 or 40% response. Prior TNF inhibitor was allowed in both studies. It was a small proportion of patients. And on the left, you see the non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis study, and on the right, the radiographic axial spondyloarthritis study. And I think what's very exciting here is that actually, regardless of whether it's radiographic or non-radiographic disease, you see that the same response is had in both populations with the same placebo response. So very similar results across two trials in two populations of axial spondyloarthritis patients using a 40% improvement compared to placebo. This is looking at the ASDAS groups. So what I want to show you here is that, of course, at baseline, both the placebo and the bimekizumab groups have very high or high disease activity. And at 16 weeks, what you see is that 46% of patients, and then in the radiographic population, 45% of patients are in low disease activity or less. So that is quite remarkable that we have such a low disease activity by only 16 weeks and very encouraging as a therapeutic option for our patients with axial spondyloarthritis. Of course, we have no head-to-head data compared to IL-17A inhibitors for primary efficacy here. And then just looking at disease, bone marrow edema, and what you can see in the non-radiographic population, looking at the sacroiliac joints, is that there's more bone marrow edema reduction in the bimekizumab group compared to the placebo group, and similarly, more bone marrow edema in the radiographic population in the bimekizumab group compared to the placebo group. So back to our case, and just remembering that she had had this amazing improvement on an IL-17A inhibitor with resolution of symptoms and signs. 14 months later, she presented with diarrhea, and she was unfortunately diagnosed with Crohn's ileitis, and this is actually from her endoscopy. And so at that point, we stopped the IL-17A inhibitor, and we started a TNF inhibitor. And unfortunately, she very quickly developed pustular anaphylaxis psoriasis that flared and was very disabling to her. This is actually from a telehealth visit where you can see the skin coming off the palms of her hands. So we then moved to a JAK inhibitor. And so I've now taken you through three classes of mechanisms. And I think it's helpful to look at this graph and think about who she is. She's axial spondyloarthritis. She also has psoriasis and now Crohn's disease. And so what are the treatment options that will work for her, and why did we choose the JAK inhibitor? Well, it's really two classes, and that's the monoclonal antibody-based TNF inhibitors. She refused to go back on to a TNF inhibitor after developing the psoriasis, and then JAK inhibitors. She has been in remission actually on a JAK inhibitor now for several years. So that is certainly an option, especially when these other options fail in the presence of multiple manifestations. I've also used off-label combination of biologics in patients with inflammatory bowel disease and axial spondyloarthritis by combining agents that we think have perhaps better safety. And I'm happy to talk about that more in the Q&A. So this is just looking at the JAK inhibitor data, and there's four trials now. Tofacitinib used an ASIS 20 or 20% improvement compared to placebo and has an indication in radiographic axial spondyloarthritis. And then you see upadacitinib both in radiographic axial spondyloarthritis and then DMARD inadequate responder and then non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis, all with efficacy compared to placebo. This is using an ASIS 40 or 40% improvement. And so very good data here to suggest that upadacitinib is a nice option for patients across the spectrum. And this is just showing you the bone marrow edema differences. And what I like about these studies, so this is both upadacitinib, this is non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis on the left, and then radiographic axial spondyloarthritis on the right. And what you see here on the left is the sacroiliac joint, and on the right is the spine. And in non-radiographic disease, you see the bigger change in the sacroiliac joints, and that's because they're non-radiographic, which means they have less damage and they have more burden of inflammation still in the sacroiliac joints. If you look at the radiographic population, the sacroiliac joints, bone marrow edema decreases, but you see more reduction actually in the SPARC spine score, and that's similarly because once you have radiographic disease, your burden of inflammation can shift to the spine. Taking into account comorbidities and re-evaluating the diagnosis in patients that don't respond is an important new recommendation from ASIS-EULAR. These are just some recent studies that have looked at this relationship and shown that in patients with high BMI, there is actually a causal association with disease activity over time. In addition, the more comorbidities you have, the less likely you are to respond to treatment. And similarly, certain comorbidities, in particular depression, is really drives both disease activity and functional impairment in a very significant way. So think about screening your patients for these comorbidities or reevaluating the diagnosis in patients that don't respond to treatment. And so here you see, just to make the point really about what to do in a patient with sustained remission, the ASIS-EULAR guidelines recommend considering tapering of the biologic DMARD. We did not recommend that in the ACR guidelines for a variety of reasons, but I want to show you some tapering data. First of all, this is the EMBARK study where patients with non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis were given etanercept and then in remission were randomized to stop or continue. And what you can see here is that 25% of these patients remain flare-free at 40 weeks of follow-up, And one of the predictors of remaining flare-free was actually if you had no bone marrow edema on the MRI prior to stopping the etanercept. So I think if you're going to have this discussion with patients, generally these patients are going to flare at some point in follow-up, but having no bone marrow edema on the MRI prior to coming off of it can be helpful. This is the ixekizumab withdrawal trial, which took all of the COAST trials and then randomized patients to stay on their ixekizumab versus come off. And you can see that between weeks 24 and 104, 53% of patients flared, so the majority of patients. However, what was helpful to see is that when you rescued these patients that flared, actually 96% of them recaptured at least low disease activity. And so that's the good news is that if you do this experiment with a patient, then there is a good chance that you're going to get them back if you try to recapture them if they flare. I'd like to talk about radiographic progression now in axial spondyloarthritis with some new data. To start, we know that very few people actually progress over at least a 2-year period. On the left, you see the MEASURE trial, MEASURE 1 with secukinumab, and on the right, you see the original phase 3 adalimumab trial compared to an OASIS observational cohort with no significant radiographic differences in those patients at 2 years. However, we have observational data that's emerged that suggests that biologics, especially when used longer, more than 2 years, are associated with less radiographic progression. And so the SURPASS trial was a trial designed to test in a head-to-head way. This is the first head-to-head trial of biologics in radiographic axial spondyloarthritis, secukinumab at 2 different doses versus an adalimumab biosimilar for a superiority design of radiographic progression. And the superiority was designed for secukinumab. This was a Novartis-funded study. And so these were patients enriched to progress. They were patients that had radiographic disease, high disease activity, and they either had to have a high C-reactive protein or they had to have at least one syndesmophyte on spinal X-rays. And you can see that the baseline characteristics of these patients had an average CRP of 20 milligrams per liter and 7 syndesmophytes at baseline. And so this was the design of the study. They were then followed for 2 years and then re-evaluated for imaging studies. These patients were dose-blinded to secukinumab, but not blinded to whether they were on secukinumab versus adalimumab. And so this is the results, and you can see the cumulative probability plot on the right, where you see very much overlapping lines of the adalimumab in red compared to the secukinumab arms in blue, suggesting actually that there is no difference in radiographic progression benefits between these two arms. And you can see that on the left, the proportion of patients with zero radiographic progression was around 66%, no matter which arm you were in. And so the cup half full here is, despite the fact that the trial did not meet its primary endpoint, is that the majority of these patients who were enriched to progress did not progress over time. And that is very encouraging, at least to help us generate supporting evidence for the fact that when you suppress inflammation long term in these patients that would be progressing at baseline without treatment, they are not progressing. I want to highlight the fact that IL-23 inhibitors are not effective. We know this phase 3 trial in ustekinumab was shut down, and then risankizumab phase 2 trial in axial spondyloarthritis also did not meet a primary endpoint. And so we have not developed IL-23 inhibitors in axial spondyloarthritis further. I think the question remains as to whether, in the setting of axial psoriatic arthritis, IL-23 inhibition would be helpful. And so this is the STAR trial, this is just showing you the study design of patients with axial psoriatic arthritis who are being randomized to guselkumab versus placebo, and then will be followed up with imaging to look at both efficacy and imaging findings. And so this will be very helpful for us to determine whether patients with axial psoriatic arthritis are truly a different endotype compared to patients with axial spondyloarthritis who do not respond to IL-23 inhibition.
Okay. Thank you, Leanne. Great session. She's going to go on, and if you want to watch the full video on Room Now or YouTube, talk about combination therapy, which is being used in GI and IBD. And there are trials being planned in spondyloarthritis as well. So I think you'll find that interesting. I like the fact that that SURPASS trial was a head-to-head. We need more of those head-to-head trials. That'll be important going ahead because it'll certainly help us to maybe make choices in which might be the better therapy, since it seems to be a level playing field according to guidelines on what you can use here once you're past non-steroidals. I want to go back to Dr. Leahy-Eder's lecture where a few things stood out to me. One, love the term enthesalgia. Never used that. I use enthesopathy, enthesitis. Now I'm adding enthesalgia to my arsenal. Another word we can confuse our colleagues with, but I think it's very appropriate. B27 becomes important, does it not, in the development of enthesitis? And that should be considered. And she makes a case for, obviously, for your, and she's a very strong advocate for ultrasound for its use. And it'll become wider in the future, especially as the units get smaller. We get the handheld units, more of you have experience with this. I think if you have it, this might be a good example. I had a really interesting discussion today with a colleague about where do you stop the line, or where's the line between fibromyalgia and spondyloarthritis, especially non-radiographic spondyloarthritis. Patients who don't meet radiographic SPA or ankylosing spondylitis definitions, but have enthesitis, or is it tender points? And they all tend to be women, and they tend to be younger, and they tend to have no. Again, this gets a little dicey, does it not? I think that ultimately ultrasound and B27 would, and then obviously further questioning on features for in favor of spondyloarthritis or features in favor of fibromyalgia, I think that helps you. We have a question from Dr. Luis Vega about can I comment on this issue of subclinical enthesitis? It was not covered by either the speakers and or in this session. And I don't think I think it goes the way of other subclinical blank, subclinical synovitis, subclinical, you know, findings. Do you treat them? So an example would be here, someone who you find enthesitis on ultrasound or MRI, are you going to treat it? Are you going to treat it if they don't have pain? I'm not going to. I don't think you need to. You know, if you do, you know, the research on MRIs done of the SI joints of hockey players, you know, manual laborers, pregnant women, they don't have spondylitis, but yet they have abnormalities that could be confused with spondylitis and they could be called subclinical findings. Same thing with doing MRIs in people who have normal joint exams or you feel are in remission, you can still find residual evidence. Do you now go after that more aggressively? Some research, early research has shown no, there's no value. So, Luis, I think that's a very good question. But until I see a trial or research telling me to do so, I'm not going to be treating subclinical enthesitis or subclinical sacroiliitis for that matter. I want to end with a review of the slides, or I'm sorry, of the survey questions that you did today. Maybe we have one more question. I think we might. No, I think we're good. And that is that we sent out some survey questions to you. 180 of you answered the survey, and let's review them here. These are survey questions stemming from this particular session at Room Now Live in 2024. And I like your answers. I think you all did really well. And so here we are, the first question, what's the first line treatment for patients with active AxSpA according to the EULAR recommendations? And it is non-steroidals. 86% of you got that right. The second question, according to the ASAS recommendations, which approach should be considered in patients with highly active persistent disease despite nonsteroidals? And you, 100% of you got it right, and that is any of the following are correct: TNF inhibitors, JAK inhibitors, or IL-17 inhibitors. The third question, according to the ASAS EULAR recommendations, IL-17 is contraindicated in patients with active inflammatory bowel disease, and the answer to that is true. Two more questions. IL-23 inhibitors are effective in axSpA. That's false. That's the last thing that we heard Dr. Gintzler talk to. And then lastly, which advanced therapy is superior in treating enthesitis in SpA and PSA? And the majority of you got it right, two-thirds of you got it right, in that there is no clear superiority of either an IL-17, a TNF inhibitor, a JAK inhibitor, et cetera. So as we close the session, if there are no further questions, I want to thank you for attending. I want you to tell your colleagues about next week's Tuesday Night Rheumatology, TNR, same time, same place, same invite. Next week, we talk about mastering lupus with really good, thoughtful lectures from David Karp at UT Southwestern about thinking preclinical disease in lupus. Then Michelle Kallenberg at University of Michigan talked about the biology and treatment of lupus flares. And lastly, from Johns Hopkins, Andrea Fava has a fabulous lecture on biomarkers in lupus management. This lecture will be available as a podcast and also as a video. It's also available on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn if you'd like to look at the live streaming. Hope you enjoyed this. We'll see you next week here on Tuesday Night Rheumatology. Thank you very much.